All right, let's take our Bibles and turn to Revelation chapter 6. Again, Revelation chapter 6 this evening, and this is part 3 of our study on the scroll with seven seals of the book of Revelation. You'll also want to use the handout or refer to it. I haven't used it as much until this evening. We'll be looking at it, in particular one of the charts that is in the handout. Now, if you're taking notes, basically what we'll be looking at this evening is the first thing we'll do is take a few minutes to review the first two parts. I think this will help before we jump into chapter 6 just to refresh our memories. I won't spend as much time on it, obviously, as before. So if you want to, you can go back and listen to the previous studies, part 1 and part 2, of course. So we'll do a review of the first two studies. And then before we begin looking at the seven seals or the content representative of, we will be looking at an overview of the judgments of Revelation, and this is where the handout will come in. So we'll do a little bit of a review briefly to review what we've looked at already. Then we'll do an overview of the judgments of Revelation and refer to the handout. I think this will be helpful to help see the flow of the book, but also how it relates to the scroll itself. This will make it helpful for the study itself, but also I think as you read Revelation in the future. And then finally, we'll look at the first seal, which is in Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. So a review, overview of the judgments of Revelation from the chart on the handout. And then we'll look at the first seal, which is in Revelation 6, verses 1 through 2. So let's begin by looking at a review, just an overview of what we've already covered. I, again, won't spend as much time as I have before, but essentially the book of Revelation, we know the author is the Apostle John, writing somewhere in the 90s AD, probably closer to 95, but in any event, 90s AD, while he is exiled on the island of Patmos, he receives, of course, the Revelation that we have recorded here. I've mentioned several times that while not the most important verse, I'm not really a fan of most important verses sometimes in books, but the book of Revelation has what I call a key verse, as opposed to, of course, the most important. But the key verse is Revelation chapter 1 and verse 19. If you remember there when we began, I told you that this gives us, if you will, the structure, or helps us get a grasp on what will come. The book of Revelation can be a little tricky, but if you use Revelation chapter 1 and verse 19, you have a pretty good idea of what is the content of the book in terms of how it flows. So you'll remember it says, John, of course, being given instructions by the risen, glorified Christ to write things which he had seen, so that's past, if you remember. That would be the things that are consisting in chapter 1. Then he says, write the things that are, meaning in the present. Those would, of course, be representative of the seven letters, seven epistles, which are chapters 2 through 3. But then in particular, notice, and the things that will take place after these things. So you have the things that he had seen, past, are, present, after, future. So that gives us a general idea. But in order to understand the scroll, which is looking to the future, it'll help us to understand, if you will, the structure of the book and the flow of things. Now, I mentioned this as well before. The outline that I have on the handout comes from the Ryrie Study Bible, and I think it's a helpful helpful outline that's on there. It's brief. If I was teaching through the whole book, I would use something like this, but I would probably expand it a little bit. But it's really helpful because if you notice, it has four main points: the prologue, sort of the introductory matters, if you will. But you'll notice the way Ryrie has it, it is, if you will, flows from or follows verse 19 of chapter 1. He says, the things which you have seen, notice chapter 1, verses 9 through 20. I would include the prologue, but nevertheless, notice it says the things which are, so that's the seven letters to the seven churches that existed in Asia Minor then. And then, of course, he has in chapter 4, verse 1 through the end of the book, the things which will take place after these things. So there you see the basic flow. Chapter 1, which you've already seen, chapters 2 through 3, the things that were present in John's day, followed by the chapter 4, verse 1, being future. Now you can see this if you remember Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1. John says, after these things, so there is a progression in Revelation. Now, I need to caution you against that doesn't mean that everything happens immediately, as you'll see through reading through the book itself. Tribulation is a 7-year period, which we'll touch on in a few minutes. But there is progression, in other words, this movement is forward. So in Revelation 4, verse 1, after these things, and then he hears a voice from heaven, notice, and it says, come up here, come up into heaven, and I'll show you what must take place after these things. So this is forward in terms of the content of the book. So chapters 4 and 5, which is where we find the scroll that we've been studying, is really one scene. Chapter 4 is easy to remember. John saw God the Father. He was seated on his throne. And essentially what you have is a chapter where the Lord is given continual worship for who he is, creator, for instance, and those sorts of things. But then if you remember, there was a change of focus in chapter 5 and verse 1. John's still up in heaven, seeing a vision of heaven in the throne room of God. In chapter 5, if you remember verse 1, the focus shifts to a scroll that's in God's hands. And there's a problem. Anyone remember what the problem was? Well, the problem was that no one was worthy to open it. So it wasn't simply that whoever the individual was, that needed to take the scroll, but they also needed to be worthy to do so. And John weeps because no one in all of creation is worthy to open it. So again, not just simply taking it, but who has worth and who is worthy to take it. Now, before we see the problem solved, let me mention one more time, what is the scroll? Now, we've used a couple of definitions. I'm just going to read the one that I have, and this is a shorter version of it, but essentially the scroll represents Jesus' right to rule the earth as king because he paid the penalty for redemption, which redeems not only mankind, but creation itself. That's the idea of the title deed. But of course, taking the title deed and expanding upon what that means, Jesus as creator, as redeemer, is in the process of not simply restoring humanity, but restoring creation, as you see right later in the latter part of the book. So the problem is solved because Jesus is from the line of the tribe of Judah. He's the root of David, but he is also overcome, which is the theme of redemption. Now, before we move on, if you remember the Lamb, he takes the scroll out of the Father's hand, which in a sense is a transfer of power, you might say, or authority, or the right to rule and to bring judgment in particular. It's a passing of the baton almost, if you think about it, from God the Father to the Lamb. And we know from John, we saw last week, that Jesus is the one through whom God the Father has given authority, but also the right to judge. And so one day everyone will stand before the judge, meaning Jesus Christ. And so obviously there is exclusivity there as well. And then finally heaven erupts at the end of chapter 5 of worship of the Lamb, Jesus Christ himself. So before we begin looking at the seals, I mentioned earlier that what I'd like for us to do is take some time to get an overview of the judgments in the book of Revelation. I think this will help show us the flow of the book again, not only as well as help with the better understanding of the scroll. So if you have a handout, you'll notice that there is the chart that says at the top, the telescopic judgments of Revelation. More often than not, charts related to Revelation, not all of them, but certainly the more prominent ones, they describe, and we've used them before in other studies, in Daniel, for instance, they show sort of an overview of the end days and such. But here you'll notice is just a little bit different, which is why I used it. So if you start on the bottom left and go to the far right, you have, of course, the cross, being the, if you will, definite changing point in human history. But then you have the block there that says the church age. And then following that, you have the seven-year tribulation. And then there's a block for the millennium. Now, of course, this purpose of this chart isn't to describe all the elements of the end times, but to focus on the judgments. So what happens? Well, we know that the Lord himself will descend from heaven and will have the rapture of the church. But remember, the trigger, or what starts or resumes the clock, and I'll clarify that in a minute, with the tribulation is not the rapture. So the rapture will occur at an unknown time, and then sometime following that, certainly an unknown amount of time, we don't know how long or how short it will be, we know that the tribulation period will start and that it's 7 years. Question is, okay, well, how do you, and where do you get that from? Well, if you remember from our study in Daniel on Sunday mornings recently, we know that Daniel is given the prophecy of the 70 weeks or 490-year prophecy. The 490-year prophecy, if you remember, is in Daniel chapter 9. And so let's turn there just for a moment to refresh our memories, because again, you have the rapture at an unknown time in the future. At some point after that, I don't know how long or how short it will be. There's no indication. But sometime following that, there will be, of course, the beginning of the tribulation period, which is 7 years. And sometimes people will say, well, where do you get 7 years from? Where does all that come from? Well, the answer to that is, if you turn to Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27, you have probably the most brief but intricate, elaborate, specific prophecy in the Bible, probably. It's the 70 weeks. Now, if you notice in verse 24 from Sunday mornings recently, you know that weeks means years. So essentially what you have is a prophecy of 490 years. 69 weeks or 483 years were accomplished related to Jesus' first coming, his crucifixion, and so forth. And you see, of course, in verse 26, the city and so forth is destroyed. All of those types of things, speaking of the destruction of 70 AD and so forth. But you'll notice in verse 26, the Messiah is cut off and have nothing. That's, of course, speaking of his death. But, of course, the question is, okay, well, then you've finished 69 weeks, 483 years. That means there's still 7 years left. But notice verse 27. This tells us what starts, probably resumes, is a better way to think of it, like a stopwatch. There's been a pause. What resumes the clock for this fulfillment? We'll notice. And he will make a firm covenant with many for, notice, 1 week or 7 years. And in the middle of the 7 years, he will make abomination of desolation and such. So we know now, going to that chart, we have the telescopic judgments of Revelation, that at some point in time in the future, we'll have a rapture, followed by a period of time where we wait on, don't know how long or how short it will be, the Antichrist to begin the clock to start the seven-year tribulation. We know the tribulation ends, if you notice on there, at the end of the series of judgments with the second coming of Jesus. Now, for our purposes, the way to think of Revelation is chapter 6 through probably about 18, roughly, is where you have the series of judgments. And if you notice on the chart, the judgments are in series of sevens. So again, you have three judgments there, each containing sevens. So said another way, the seven seals consist of seven judgments, or they're representative of seven judgments. Notice the next, you have the seven trumpets. Those are representative of seven judgments. And then finally, the third sequence is the seven vials or bowls. Those are all judgments. And so what happens is you have a series of sevens, if you will, meaning a series of three judgments and sevens. Now, just for trivia purposes, what I'm going to ask you is, are there any other series of judgments of sevens that are in Revelation? Well, the answer to that is, of course, yes. I've always found it fascinating that there are seven thunders. You find this in Revelation chapter 10, verses 1 through 7. So it's curious, and it's always fascinated me, is that the Lord does not reveal all the content of the future to us. And it's very easy to see that in Revelation 10, verses 1 through 7, because the seven thunders, John's getting ready to record the content and is told, don't do it. Seal it up, in other words, don't write the content down. So again, the Lord doesn't always reveal everything to us. He does reveal some things to us, but not all things to us. All right, so the last thing we're going to do with these judgments is one other thing, and I think you'll find it helpful here. If you notice, in the seven-year tribulation, you have the judgments there, obviously, the seals, the trumpets, and the vials slash bowls. But one of the things that is helpful in a study of this, and I want you to turn, if you're in chapter 6 of Revelation, notice the sixth seal is mentioned for the first time in verse 12. It says, I looked when he broke the sixth seal. And we'll cover this in a few weeks. But for this purpose, you'll notice it goes through the end of chapter 17 and then it ends. And the question is, okay, well, the chapter ended. What happened to the seventh seal? Well, if you notice chapter 7, the entirety of chapter 7 is, it's an interlude, technically, but basically it's almost like you're watching a movie and there's a pause and it reflects back on something or shifts to another scene. In this case, you'll notice that it shifts from the earth in chapter 6 to the heavens, in other words, to heaven in chapter 7, and it gives the interlude. That is the period here where we see the 144,000 witnesses and so forth. But then notice in chapter 8 and verse 1, the judgments resume. Revelation chapter 8 verse 1, when the Lamb broke the seventh seal, so that's where the seventh seal is, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And then, of course, what flows from that is the trumpets. So what I want you to see here is that the seventh judgment of each of these is what triggers or is what flows out of the next judgment. So said another way, the seventh seal triggers the first trumpet judgment. In other words, once the seventh seal is completed, it is the, if you will, inaugurates or ushers forth what follows. Said another way, the seventh trumpet will blow, and then from that will come the seven vials or seven bowl judgments. Now, let's move on here to see here the first seal. So we've covered the review, we've looked at the overview of judgments, and as you look at these judgments, one of the things that's good to think of is, have we ever seen judgments like this on a scale in which it's described in the book? And of course, the answer would be no. You'll see that these judgments, we won't be going through, but the seal judgments, but the judgments themselves get progressively more increased, a third of the earth, and these great calamities come. So while we get previews, there are types of this that occur throughout history. What occurs in the future in Revelation hasn't occurred yet. Now, when we finish the study, we will look at comparing the Olivet Discourse, the early part, to these six seals and see how they compare and so forth. So hopefully that'll kind of round out the study before we finish. But let's look at Revelation chapter 6, and I'm going to read verses 1 and 2, and we'll look at the first seal tonight. All right, so let's go ahead and read Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. Then I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a loud voice of thunder, "Come." I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Not too long ago, someone asked me, are the four horsemen of the apocalypse real? Or in other words, where do they come from? The idea or the phrase. And actually, what we're going to be looking at this week and next week is where they originate from. The first four seals are where we get the idea of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. If you look at the comparison chart with Matthew 24, which we'll do at the end of the study, to close things out, you'll notice in the right-hand column you have the white, red, black, pale, or in Greek, ashen horse. There, the pale horse. You have the what we call four horsemen of the apocalypse. If you've ever seen a picture of it, that is what we have. So the white horse is in verse 2, the red in verse 4. Verse 5 is the black horse, and finally the fourth one is the pale horse in verse 8. But for tonight, we're looking at the first seal, which is the white one. Now, of course, it's important with these to remember, as we go through these, that Jesus, obviously as titled the Lamb, is the one who is allowing, permitting these things to go forth. He's in total control. He decides when these events will occur and such. Now, he's permitting them, of course, allowing them to come. God sometimes uses, I like to think of maybe the Assyrians, the Babylonians. He sometimes would use those, if you will, wicked nations or various tools or instruments to bring judgment, in those cases, on even his own people. So just remember, it's the idea of allowing or permitting, and sometimes God uses those things as, I guess you'd say, instruments to bring forth those things. So allowing and permitting. But the question that comes up, of course, is who is the one on the white horse? Because clearly it's a he. You see, as we go look at verse 2, he is sitting on it, of course, with a bow, and he's given ultimately a crown. There's a lot of references or interpretations of who this is. Some would say, for instance, a Roman emperor. There's a lot of people that might suggest something like that. That is for those who believe that it was already fulfilled, already meaning the Revelation prophecy is already fulfilled. Obviously, I don't hold to that. But typically what you'll get is that the person that sits on it, the he in verse 2, is either Jesus or Antichrist, or Antichrist, plural. Now, the one about Jesus is easily for me to be refuted, because Jesus is the one who opens the scroll. Jesus has distinguished himself from a rider on a horse. He's the Lamb. At the end of Revelation, when he comes, he doesn't bring war. He brings an end to it. He comes with a sword, and you notice here is a bow. So I take this to be more of not Jesus, because if you notice as well, he's given a crown. That crown is a Stephanos crown, which isn't what Jesus wears. He wears the crown of many diadems. So too many things against the interpretation of it being Jesus. I think it's curious that he is on a white horse first, because Jesus does ride in on a white horse. But we see that this is, I believe, clearly a false or counterfeit Jesus, just as Jesus mentioned, we'll see at the end of the study in a few weeks in the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24, verses 4 through 5, the false Christ. I think this is the epitome, though, meaning the Antichrist. If you bear with me here, let me read this to you. It's from David Levy. He says, "This rider, the white horse, in other words, has the markings of a counterfeit Antichrist, who arrives on the world stage at the beginning of the tribulation." And I think he's correct. I think that's the correct way to see it, is that way, meaning that there were many antichrists. There have been throughout history. There will continue to be, First John, but they will eventually culminate in the Antichrist. And I think this fits well there. You'll notice, for example, as well, that has a bow. but he's got no arrows. I think a misnomer sometimes is that when Antichrist comes, all hell breaks loose on earth immediately. On one hand, I suppose there is a truth to that because the tribulation does start. But remember, Antichrist comes, if you will, peacefully, at least in a public setting. We've already seen that in Daniel 9:27. It's really at the midpoint that his true nature, his true character comes out. I think that, again, you do have difficulties. You do have, obviously, these great cataclysms. But in terms of Antichrist, I think his full character nature isn't really revealed into the midpoint, which is what you see, for instance, in 2 Thessalonians as well. So he comes peacefully and so forth, and he comes forward to conquer. He's given a crown and the ability to do these things. I want you to consider, though, for a second, Antichrist, how long is he allowed to do these things, and what does that tell us? Well, if you look at Revelation 13:5, you can turn there if you like, but essentially this is the beast and the dragon. And it says in verse 4 of Revelation 13, they worshiped the dragon because he has given authority to the beast, so Satan and the Antichrist there. But if you notice verse 5, it says, there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. Again, these are allusions or references as well to the book of Daniel. But you'll notice that he's given only 42 months. The point I want you to see here is Antichrist's time is difficult, it's horrific, but it's also brief. He will be a world ruler, but his time is brief, and God is the one who determines his timetable. God is the one who determines when he rises, when he falls. This should not surprise us as students of the Word, because in Daniel, God allows, if you will, evil, wicked rulers and nations to rise and fall. He uses them for his own purposes. In many cases, you see that here. So the question is, who's in control? Well, the Lord sets the timetable for him. He's in control even when there is evil unlike anything we will ever have seen on the earth. The Lord is still in control of the timetable, we might say, and where things are headed. I want us to stop here for a second as we've kind of covered this, but I want us to look at something and maybe drive home this point a little bit. Turn with me to 2 Chronicles before we finish. And next week we'll finish the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Of course, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th seals. But in 2 Chronicles 20, a good lesson for us as we finish. Jehoshaphat was one of the kings of Judah. He was one of the, I say, relatively good kings. He was good. He had his shortcomings and fallings, or shortcomings rather, like all of them in many ways, David included. But Jehoshaphat had learned a lesson. Beforehand, he had aligned himself not only with Ahab, but sought the Lord, did not seek the Lord before battle, and things did not turn out well. But in Jehoshaphat, we see in 2 Chronicles 20, if you're not familiar with the setting, essentially the setting is that Judah is surrounded and is getting ready to be attacked. And he's afraid, Jehoshaphat is. And Jehoshaphat knows that, for all intents and purposes, they're probably going to get wiped out. And he turns to the Lord. Verse 4, he sought the help of the Lord, and he pointed the people to the Lord's help. And he knew that was the only place to turn. He had learned his previous lesson, we might say, from chapter 18. But you'll notice in verse 6, as he goes into this beautiful prayer, he says, O Lord, the God of our fathers, are you not God in the heavens? And are you not the ruler over all the kingdoms of the nations? Power and might are in your hands, so that no one can stand against you. Obviously, these are all rhetorical questions, but notice, God alone, no one can stand against him. Our hope is always rooted in the character of God, which does not or ever will change. The fact of the matter is that the same God that Jehoshaphat prays for, who is ruler over everything, no one can triumph over him. All power and might are in his hand. All power and might is not in the hand of Satan or into the Antichrist, and ultimately the Lord always prevails It's not a question of debate. It's just a fact, and God never changes, and we need to, like Jehoshaphat, turn to him and turn to remember that he alone is able to do these things. Many of the problems we have and that I encounter, not only personally as a pastor, but questions brought to me, quite honestly, are those that are rooted, the answers are, that is, in the character of God. God is good, he is powerful, and he will prevail. Jehoshaphat in verse 12 says, O our God, will you not judge them? For we are powerless before this great multitude who are coming against us, nor do we know what to do. But notice, but our eyes are on you. The focus is always on the Lord. The Lord is more powerful than any earthly kingdom or ruler. He's more powerful than the Antichrist, the false prophet, and even Satan himself. Now, in the next week, we'll cover the seals 2, 3, 4, in other words, the rest of the four horsemen. But until then, I'm going to close with this poem slash hymn, probably familiar with, and then we'll close. And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God hath willed his truth to triumph through us. The prince of darkness grim, we tremble not for him. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. One little word shall fail him. Amen.